The new Netflix anthology, Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities, looks at horror storytelling from many angles. Its 8 installments come from different directors, and it includes both new stories and adaptations of tales from writers like H.P. Lovecraft. The cast is stacked with interesting actors. The tales are set in periods both past and disturbingly present. And the mix of the tragic and the comic and the just plain scary and gross is meant to serve a lot of different horror appetites. I'm Linda Holmes, and today we're talking about Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining us today is freelance journalist Cristina Escobar. She's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of LatinaMedia.co. Also with us is NPR Consider This producer Mark Rivers. Hello to both of you.
Hey, Linda.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, good to be here.
I am delighted to have you both. The first thing to know about Cabinet of Curiosities is probably that Guillermo del Toro, who's of course a celebrated director, didn't direct any of the 8 stories in this anthology. He wrote the stories behind 2 of them, and he does an introduction at the top of each, very much in the style of the introductions Alfred Hitchcock and Rod Serling did for Alfred Hitchcock Presents and The Twilight Zone. But he brought in directors who, in most cases, already have impressive credits in the world of horror, and he's really described this as a showcase for directing. We'll talk more about some of these stories, obviously, but some of them include The Outside, stars Kate Micucci and Martin Starr in a parable about infomercial hucksters, directed by Anna Lily Amirpour, who made A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Pickman's Model is an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation starring Crispin Glover as a creepy painter. That one is directed by Keith Thomas, who just did the recent Firestarter. And The Murmuring, my personal favorite of the set, reunites director Jennifer Kent with her The Babadook star Essie Davis, as well as Andrew Lincoln, for a good old ghost story about haunted houses, grief, and birds. All 8 chapters are streaming now on Netflix. I want to start with you, Cristina. Tell me your sort of general impressions of the series.
Overall, I liked Cabinet of Curiosities. I thought, like with many anthologies, it was uneven. Some were very scary, I thought, and some were not at all. Some really worked for me. And especially as you mentioned, The Murmuring, the last episode lingered and had me thinking about its themes long after it had ended. Others I thought were not so great. I would say I really love watching, seeing someone with a Mexican accent on regular shows speaking with well-earned authority. I am interested in Guillermo del Toro as an artist. I thought even though he didn't direct them, you could certainly see his touch in the monsters, in the themes, and that part was exciting. I also think, you know, del Toro has been criticized within the community for maybe not always bringing Latinos with him, for sometimes making more like white or white-focused, Anglo-focused movies and films. And I didn't see that here. There was a broad representation, which I was excited about, both in front of and behind the camera. And overall, I think that sort of regardless of what your preferred type of horror is, that there's probably at least one episode in here that is going to speak to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said, some of them are more like gooey and gross, and some of them are more, you know, The Murmuring is much more kind of one of those, like I said, a ghost story with kind of trauma and things like that to explore. Mark, what are your feelings about the series across the board?
There's an unmistakable print of del Toro on these stories. Like, a lot of my notes amounted to yuck, gross. You know, this guy is a master of that kind of just gross out horror, and he can revel in it in some of his previous films. And I think the anthology format makes sense for someone like del Toro. You know, like I'm thinking about The Twilight Zone or Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Like a Hitchcock, del Toro is a showman. You know, unlike Hitchcock, he's a showman for the creepy and the crawly. I think, like you said, Cristina, there are some episodes that just did not really work for me. It felt like narrative contraption kind of coming together rather than something that's really going to linger. I think Cabinet of Curiosity is a very kind of apropos title. It made me think I was kind of rummaging through my grandparents', you know, stuff in like an attic and like pulling out drawers and, oh, this is kind of interesting. Oh, this is kind of weird. And then you kind of forget about it a week or so later. I think the best episode for me, like you said, Linda, was The Murmuring that Jennifer Kent directed. I think Jennifer Kent is responsible for one of the best of recent horror films, The Babadook. And I think, like that movie, she has a way of making making these external and surreal horrors kind of exacerbate the internal horrors of the characters in a way that's really believable and very unnerving. That episode kind of had traces of, you know, Shirley Jackson, Turn of the Screw. But it was its own thing. And it was also, it looked, you know, it had an aesthetic that was different from the other ones. It was very beautiful. You know, these shots of the two characters in the story, they study kind of just birds' movements and migrations in the air, murmurings. And there are these just lovely shots of these birds against the early light, you know. And, you know, that's the episode that kind of like stayed with me after it was over.
Yeah.
But the rest of them were kind of hit and miss.
I thought The Murmuring succeeded in really being haunting.
Yeah.
You know, it's a haunted house story, but it haunted, I felt, me. And had that sort of deep themes. And for me, I prefer that type of horror. I think that the terrible things that people do, the human monsters, are much more scary in many ways than the fantastical monsters because it feels more real. It feels like maybe a terrible, terrible trap you could fall into or someone you know could fall into. And so, yes, there are fantastical elements in The Murmuring, but the real horror and tragedy is about what people do to each other. And that, to me, is so scary.
Yeah.
It can be so scary to imagine. Yeah.
And I think Del Toro's work kind of shows that those are his best qualities. And I think his best movies, The Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth, they show his, you know, his wonderful imagination, but it is grounded in real human cost and real human pain in a way that kind of, that I think, like, unleashes him. And I think when he's kind of operating in these other worlds, like these worlds that are not recognizable and not real, it's brighter, it's more colorful, but I think more easily dismissed to me than his more real world horror allegories.
Yeah. One of the things that was interesting to me about watching this is that I often don't identify myself as like a horror person, but I grew up reading a ton of Stephen King, right? Mm-hmm. And I think part of what has happened is that theatrical films that are in the horror genre have come to be, you know, particularly the ones that make the most money, that get the most promotion from studios, have come to be very heavily dominated on like really gross, slashery, horrible murder kind of stuff. And that is not necessarily the kind of horror that I care about the most. And I don't think very many of these stories that I can think of really have much of that element in it. It's not that they're not gross, right? But they're not, it's not horror in the sense of terrible murderers running around town, just knocking off person after person after person. And with all of these, even though I was more into some than others, with most of them, there was at least something that from a filmmaking perspective or a writing perspective was interesting for me to think about. And one of the reasons for that is that I do think the casting is interesting and strong, and a lot of these people are interesting. And I was interested in how they were used. You know, I mentioned there's this one called The Outside where Kate Micucci plays a woman who feels kind of like an outcast. She feels like an ugly duckling. She's married to a police officer played by Martin Starr. So those are both people who, you know, have done a ton of more straight up comedy kind of stuff. And they're in this story that is really pretty sad in a lot of ways, even though it has also kind of comedic elements. She gets sucked in by a kind of an infomercial guy who, by the way, is played by Dan Stevens, who I think is really trying very hard to make sure that everybody knows he is not the handsome Downton Abbey guy for the rest of his life, because he just keeps doing really weird stuff, including this.
He really wants us to, like, just totally forget that, I feel like, with some of these roles. Just, he's completely rejecting that past. And I love it.
I think it's so true. I think he's been running the other way, I think, ever since he left that show, which I find fascinating. And I think Kate Micucci is a comedic. She is a comic actress. And some of this performance feels comic to me, but some of it feels kind of pitiable. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, if you haven't been sort of following the idea of who Crispin Glover is long enough to remember him kind of going on late night television and kicking and just like, I think he kicked at David Letterman. I think it was David Letterman. He was sort of this notoriously weird guy after he had been in, you know, a couple of indie movies and also in obviously Back to the Future, which was, you know, this kind of mainstream hit. And I haven't seen a lot from him in a really long time. And seeing him pop up as this kind of quietly super creepy painter in this episode, Pickman's Model, that I otherwise wasn't terribly into. I'm not really a Lovecraft person. That's not my appetite when it comes to horror. But I did enjoy the casting of him in that and just seeing him be this, like, he's not like, you know, being a super over the top creepy guy. He's being like a quietly creepy guy.
Yeah, very understated, but to me, almost like loud in its understatement. Like it's so vividly Glover, right. You know, like, and his presence to me felt as inevitable as like a Michael Caine in a Christopher Nolan movie for me. Like when
really
I saw him,
true.
I was like, oh, of course he's here. Like of course.
It's really true. Christina, what were your thoughts about casting?
I thought there was a lot of strong casting and it did make a big difference. You spoke about The Outside and I felt like that one was beautifully casted, but perhaps one of the more frustrating ones for me. I felt like in many ways it was meant to serve me as someone who is like interested in feminism, I guess, to put one word on it, but also like women bodily horror. Like I still remember when I walked out of The Black Swan thinking that was the scariest movie I'd ever seen mm-hmm, because it mm-hmm. spoke to so much like feminine particular body horror.
Right.
But The Outside did not work for me because it had what I felt like was a really simplistic view on beauty and how it works, that there are ugly mm-hmm. people and there are beautiful people and sort of never the two shall meet, which is not at all sort of my experience. Or I think just even the idea that you could become a grown woman and never have become beautiful and had an interest in it, like never tried before, and then you sort of be sucked into this cult. It just made no sense to me as someone who wanted to like it and enjoy it. But what did work about The Outside, I felt, and I really love things that mix comedy and horror, and mm-hmm. I thought it did that really successfully.
Yeah.
So I saw a lot of strongness in that. I felt like in the first three episodes, which I thought were the most just like straight up scary in terms of like gooey monster stuff.
Right, I agree.
Those all had really interesting main character castings in terms of men, they were all men who you could see, whether it's fighting rodents of unusual size or doing autopsies of bodies, you could see why they were casted, how it played out on their faces, and what made them sort of so interesting in the role and making the horror just a little bit bigger, whether it's by their quietness or by their sort of over-the-top facial expressions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mark, I got the impression from you that those first, particularly those first three, the kind of like monster ones, were not particularly effective monster stories for you. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but where did you come down on kind of those monster stories? The Lot 36, which is the storage unit that turns out to kind of open a sort of portal to things you don't want to mess mm-hmm. around with, and Graveyard Rats, which really is literally about a graveyard and rats, and The Autopsy, right, with that really freaky F. Murray Abraham mm-hmm. performance at the center, and the amazing Glenn Turman, who I'm always happy to see in anything. What was your reaction mm-hmm. to kind of those monster stories?
Yeah, I mean, the first two to me got off on kind of a poor start because they both had a similar story going. You have these two kind of disreputable people mm-hmm. who owe some debt to even more disreputable people, and they're finding the most disreputable way to fix that debt. And the stories don't really give you enough to care about these people. Like, it's all about the ick factor, the discovery of the ick, you know, in the first one, and also just like the constant ick of the second one, where this guy is just, he is basically among the rats for the entirety of the story. If your phobia is enclosed spaces with rats, definitely skip episode two.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought those two just didn't really amount to much. I do think the casting is what keeps it watchable. F. Murray Abraham has just this grizzled melancholy that is just so watchable. And he kind of has it, and you kind of have Glenn Turman's competing melancholy going on in that episode. But then the final moments of that episode kind of is this exposition dump. And it mm-hmm. feels like the third act of a movie that we didn't see the first two acts of. And you're just like, wait, why are you explaining all of this when you've not given me enough reason to care about what's happening? And all of a sudden,
I don't feel like I need to know all this.
I don't need to know. Like, I know you're about to wreak some havoc. That's all I need to know. You don't need to explain why.
Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting is that Christina was talking about the story of The Outside. And I did feel the same. You really, as you were talking about it, Christina, I felt like, yes, that is a thing that I hadn't put my finger on, but that thematically felt very old-fashioned to me. That felt to me like sort of an 80s movie mm-hmm. about the idea of a quote-unquote ugly duckling being tormented by pretty women. And I do think it's interesting how this show plays with period, because one of the ones that I was the most fascinated by in the sense that I just felt like I did not get it was The Viewing, which is this one where these four people, without giving it away, I will just say the whole thing is kind of this 70s drug trip story. There is a creature, as is often true in these things, but I really felt like I did not get it. And I felt like if you are not a person who really gets into kind of the horror of like altered states and drug stories, I don't know what you would take away from that. Am I confused by, am I getting that story wrong?
I think the confusion is a part of it. Like that whole episode to me was just a vibe.
It was all vibes. Yes.
You had this kind of like 80s synth going, and then you have this 80s icon in Peter Weller, you know, from RoboCop. There's a little bit of like 80s horror with like face melting. I was thinking of Raiders of the Lost Ark at the end of this episode.
Oh, for sure.
And it was like the house they were in was like some, like a Hygge lounge in the Blade Runner universe or something.
Yeah.
I didn't know why any of this was happening, but I kind of enjoyed that one because it was just unapologetically doing this thing.
Yeah, you had to just let go and enjoy the vibe, like the music, just
let go,
relax,
get the contact high from like the episode, and like that's it.
Yeah, it was quite a whiplash going from that to The Murmuring, which is that final episode. Because I do think, and we have talked about this one, but I really felt like that I would have watched, I think, as a feature.
Totally.
I mean, I think it's perfectly fine as an hour long installment, but I think that Essie Davis performance is so good. And there is so much in this story that could have really been kind of horror cliche in the sense that these people have been through a trauma, they're in a haunted house. I mean, anytime you involve large flocks of birds in a horror movie, it can easily go very broad, and it doesn't, which surprised me. The stuff with the birds is kept fairly restrained and it really stays on these people. I was really surprised how quickly I was very invested in these two characters and the marriage that they have. I think the story, which Guillermo del Toro wrote the story for this one, I think the story does a great job of keeping open the idea that both of these people are decent and love each other, and there's all this pain. Like, nobody is the good one or the bad one. They're just trying to get through this traumatic experience. And like I said, for a piece that could have gone horror cliche in a bunch of places, it was the one that to me, I just thought, oh, this is just a story that I would have happily watched a feature. And I don't know whether any of these other ones made me think like I would happily watch another 45 minutes of that.
I think what was really impressive about that episode is it just felt so patient in its development of these characters and its development of the kind of the fears and the scares. Nothing was too over the top. It felt like the scares creeped in. They didn't like kind of jump into your face, you know, and you're allowed to kind of settle into the story in the way that the other stories, it just wasn't there for me. So I think just what the anthology was trying to do, that episode was most clearly successful in presenting that.
Yeah, I thought The Murmuring was beautiful and quiet.
For sure.
Where some of them, maybe all of the rest of them, were maximalist, it seems, in their aesthetics, you know, from like
point.
That brightly colored 80s and The Autopsy to some of like The Darkness.
I mean, when you have the director of Twilight and like Mandy on this thing, it's going to be loud.
Yeah, there was a lot of loud. There were a lot of bright colors. There were a lot of like darkness.
Mm-hmm.
But The Murmuring seemed to take place in like our actual world, and a world that could be beautiful but also horrifying. And I think that juxtaposition really worked for me. And maybe to put a perhaps false value judgment on it, felt a little more adult, right?
Yes.
Felt a little more grown up in its understanding of what can be really, really scary. But also beautiful and profound. Like, it had more than just scary, which I felt like jumped it up a couple of levels versus many of the other ones in there that didn't have as much of those other elements.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and I think, again, you know, you're going back to like, we've returned a couple times to the fact that even in the ones of these that don't fully work creatively, they did a really nice job casting them with people who are kind of interesting to watch. So I think they succeed and fail in different ways. But, you know, most of them have something, if that's your thing, which sounds more negative than I felt about this series, which I mostly did enjoy. But we want to know what you think about Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Mark Rivers, Christina Escobar, thanks so much to both of you for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second and you're so inclined, sign up for our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. This episode was produced by Chloe Weiner and edited by Jessica Reedy, and Hello Come In provides our theme music. I'm Linda Holmes, and we'll see you all tomorrow when we will be talking about The Banshees of Inisharan.